The Cystic Fibrosis Foundation is truly the most admirable disease-fighting organization in the world.
Says one man who has cystic fibrosis, but has the organization gone too far in reinventing how drugs are developed?
The cost of this drug alone is six times the median household income in America. That seems pretty outrageous.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
You can think of your genome as a piano.
Being blind from birth, I had to actually learn to think like a sighted person.
Really, the most important thing to make this a success is that the primary care providers have to buy into it.
Always maintain hope.
Fear is woven into the daily existence of medicine.
Neutrinos are some of the fundamental
parts. To particles. See that in the arc of a career is
they literally
have
to teach them like what a pencil was.
Right, you see the gene gap.
I may get frustrated.
Slow down the rate at which water temperatures are increasing.
On today's show, a pretty gross approach to avoiding winter colds, a science fiction approach to reading vital signs, and a sex equality approach to research. But first up, a story that raises more than a few ethical questions. Should a nonprofit foundation make $3.3 billion selling royalty rights for a drug that treats its own donors and members? Can we as a society afford to pay for a drug that costs more than $300,000 a year for the rest of a patient's life? Carolyn Beeler has the story about the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation and the drug Kalydeco it pushed to have created.
Cystic fibrosis is a genetic disorder that causes thick mucus to build up in the lungs and pancreas. That mucus leads to digestive problems, lung infections, difficulty breathing, and a life expectancy of around 40 years. The drug Kalydeco was approved by the FDA in 2012, and it's the first to treat the root cause of the disease instead of just its symptoms. For patient Sean O'Malley, the drug was literally an answer to his prayers.
You know, growing up with this disease, it was something that was always talked about, you know, a cure or even just a drug like this that would come along and really help people with cystic fibrosis. So it was life-changing. So when it did come out, it was revolutionary.
The 27-year-old Mechanicsburg resident is one of only about 1,000 patients in the entire United States with the genetic mutation that this drug targets. Since he started taking it about 2 years ago, O'Malley gained 15 pounds, stayed out of the hospital, and has breathed easier than ever before.
Stuff normal people without cystic fibrosis would take for granted. I mean, going up a large flight of stairs or jogging to catch the bus, you know, anything like that could have left me winded and holding all my friends back. And really, that's something that's gone by the wayside ever since starting this drug.
O'Malley says he was shocked by the drug's $311,000 a year sticker price, but he only has to pay a $15 a month copay. That's because to make sure people can actually afford to take this drug, Vertex Pharmaceuticals has a patient assistance program. It pays for O'Malley's deductible each year and for the deductibles of other patients on private insurance. It also helps with copays and gives the drug away for free to uninsured people who make less than $150,000 a year. That means the insurance companies are the ones actually paying for this drug. And really, that means anyone who pays insurance premiums or taxes that go to Medicaid. You, me, and everyone else. The drug's high price is raising eyebrows, despite the patient assistance program. Last month, some of that attention moved over to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation when it sold its royalty rights to Kalydeco and future drugs for $3.3 billion. University of Pennsylvania ethicist Zeke Emanuel says what the foundation owes its members and donors from that payout isn't yet clear.
To be honest, we're not 100% sure. This is uncharted territory, and thinking through exactly what we think the obligations are is brand new.
The Cystic Fibrosis Foundation isn't the only one practicing venture philanthropy, providing early seed money to spur drug research and potentially reaping rewards later on. But the size of this payout, that is unique.
The big windfall they're getting is not a direct result of the successful drug. It's a direct result of the successful drug priced at a very high price. And that high price is a direct impact on many, many cystic fibrosis families, including some that helped contribute.
A spokesman for Vertex defended the drug's price, saying it has a broad benefit for patients and took 14 years to bring to market. Cystic Fibrosis Foundation President Bob Bell says he, too, has concerns about the drug's cost, and he didn't have a say in pricing it. But the foundation sold its royalty rights when it did to turn that money into research funding for a cure.
No one's profiting here. We're going to make the investment back to the patients. The only conflict of interest would be we may not make these kinds of investments.
Last month's payout is a return on a $150 million foundation investment in Vertex to get the company to start researching cystic fibrosis, which only affects about 30,000 patients in the entire country.
And they will tell you today that these drugs would not have been available had we not de-risked them.
Kalydeco only works for roughly 1,000 Americans with cystic fibrosis. Last month, Vertex submitted a second drug for FDA approval that would target a different mutation and could treat up to 8,500 Americans in combination with Kalydeco. That would bring relief to more people, but also cost insurance companies and Medicaid programs billions. National Association of Medicaid Directors head Matt Salo says recent high-cost specialty drugs have pushed his members to more closely scrutinize new treatments.
It has fundamentally changed the conversation, and now everything that comes out of the pipeline is going to be looked at to say, you know, not just is this a great breakthrough, but has this been priced in such a way that has made it unsustainable in the real world?
Part of the problem, he argues, is that drug companies think figuring out how to pay for their expensive treatment is somebody else's problem.
And I think that is, unfortunately, not a very helpful attitude because we are all paying for this. This is a program that is funded entirely by state and federal taxpayer dollars. And there is a vested interest in all of us in making sure that the program is going to continue to be around for the people who are going to need it.
As for the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, ethicist Zeke Emanuel says it will have to tread lightly to bring new therapies to market without overly burdening patients financially.
The experience with that kind of dilemma has made drug companies persona non grata. People look at them very suspiciously. And if the foundation is not going to tarnish its image, it's probably going to have to figure out how to reconcile those two ethical imperatives. And so far, I don't think they have.
Others disagree. Since it was founded in Philadelphia in the 1950s, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation has sponsored many of the major medical breakthroughs in the field. It commands incredible trust from doctors and patients like Sean O'Malley. He believes their promise to reinvest the $3.3 billion to find a cure.
In my experience with the foundation, that seems to be their first and utmost priority.
O'Malley doesn't have a problem with the foundation's big windfall, even if we're all eventually paying the bill. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
So what do you make of this approach and how it might impact how drugs are developed? Email us at thepulse@whyy.org.
Space, the final frontier.
The prescient words of William Shatner's Captain James T. Kirk, the tortured hero of the original Star Trek TV series. The show sure had its hokey moments with psychedelic sets and Shatner's penchant for dramatic flair.
I'm losing command. I'm losing the Enterprise. Ship is sailing on and on. I'm alone.
But it turns out some of the technology the crew of the Starship Enterprise relied on was maybe more influential on a generation of scientists than we had previously thought. Reporter Zach Seward has this tale of a high-stakes medical device competition inspired by the sci-fi classic and a local team boldly going into the finals.
It all starts with the very first season of Star Trek, a dream of the 1960s, and one Dr. Leonard McCoy.
You're 4-0.
Four?
4-0, 100%. Sound of wind and limb.
The tricorder, a handheld medical device about the size of an old tape recorder for diagnosing the many ailments encountered by the crew of the Starship Enterprise.
Open your mouth.
Well, I thought the machine was...
The machine is capable of almost anything. I'll still put my trust in a healthy set of tonsils. Now open your mouth.
It lived on in the Star Trek universe, evolving over time. But now, here on 21st century Earth, the tricorder may become a real-life medical instrument. The final frontier is here.
Dr. Harris, room 9 now, please.
I'm Basil Harris. I'm an ER doctor based at Lankenau Hospital. Right outside of Philadelphia, and that's what I do full-time, and my part-time endeavor is building tricorders.
Harris leads a team competing in the Qualcomm Tricorder X Prize, a challenge that dangles a $10 million carrot to build the next great consumer-focused health tool. And his team, called Final Frontier Medical Devices, is one of 10 finalists worldwide.
So the idea of the tricorder originally in the Star Trek world was a device that was still in the hands of Dr. McCoy.
But the entries into the tricorder competition go beyond that.
What XPRIZE has done is actually taken it a step further and taken the doctor out of the equation and making it into an autonomous device.
You can think of it as a really souped-up thermometer, a scanning device that records your vital signs and other health metrics, and then, here's the hard part, offers up a diagnosis of what's wrong with you.
It guides you through a process and has a dynamic flow to it. So if you have a certain set of symptoms, it'll guide you towards a certain set of tests that you might need.
That's what Harris's team is trying to achieve. Using a tablet and a few wireless monitoring devices, they're turning to the power of algorithms to basically put a doctor in the palm of your hand, something that asks you questions and guides you to the proper course of medical action.
It's a huge responsibility, and that is why we've done a validation study on our algorithms based on real medical data from actual patients with these conditions to understand, you know, are these algorithms robust enough.
It's an approach that makes Harris's team stand out, for better or worse. For instance, their device, unlike some other teams, doesn't deal with blood samples. Dr. Eric Veery, the technical and medical director of the Tricorder XPRIZE, says most of Final Frontier's competitors are taking a more sensor-heavy approach.
However, the Final Frontier team has really hung their hat on artificial intelligence. So their goal is to use artificial intelligence systems to be able to make queries to people, and then using that, zero in on the various possible medical conditions that a person might have.
Veery is also a physician at UC San Diego, and that's where the next big milestone in the XPRIZE competition takes place. Next summer, the 10 finalists have to deliver their prototype tricorders so they can be rigorously tested on volunteer patients suffering from the diseases outlined by the competition. There's over a dozen of those ailments, ranging from sleep apnea to stroke to tuberculosis. The device that can most accurately pinpoint the health conditions wins the big prize.
What we want to accomplish in our competition is to demonstrate the feasibility, the reality of that.
Veery is a Trekkie himself. He owns a Star Trek uniform, the blue one, of course, from sickbay. He says building another thing from Star Trek will be cool enough in and of itself. I mean, we already have mobile phones, which are kind of like the show's communicators.
All joking aside, I think one of the most important things that will happen from our competition is the use of the word tricorder. I think tricorder will become one of these words like Kleenex, you know, that ultimately becomes part of the parlance.
It's a grand vision shared by Basil Harris back at Lankenau Hospital. In a spare exam room dressed in scrubs, he says his emergency room work has absolutely informed how he's approaching this tricorder thing, namely, patient first.
I work here in the ER all the time, and people come in with little scraps of paper with their blood pressure readings, their glucose readings, and I imagine a day when patients are coming in and saying, hey, I have this tricorder device, and it's telling me that I have pneumonia, you know, and I want to be at a point where I trust that data.
It's still very early, Harris cautions.
There are many hurdles to achieve that level through the FDA, through regulatory processes, but that's the future.
Consider it a moonshot within reach, another once wacky idea from science fiction made real.
Risk. Risk is our business. That's what this starship is all about. That's why we're aboard her.
For The Pulse, I'm Zach Suit.
Coming up on The Pulse, disinfecting hospitals gets a high-tech makeover.
The more technology you have in a room, the more surface area you have in a room. The more surface area you have, the more difficult it is to have a human actually clean it.
Still to come on The Pulse, here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. IBC believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. With doctors and hospitals across the region, Independence Blue Cross is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support designed to help you live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Disinfectants may not hold a very glamorous place in the world of healthcare, but inadequate cleanup puts patients at risk. Hospital-acquired infections remain a huge challenge for the system, with outbreaks costing both lives and money. A Delaware company might have a way to reduce the spread of pathogens in medical settings, and the tool could also be used to fight the spread of Ebola. Todd Bookman reports.
Inside a hospital, patient A may never come into direct contact with patient B. There could be hours or days separating when the first gets discharged and the second checks in. But serious infections are still routinely transmitted between the two.
If you have somebody in a hospital room that has an infection, the room is not properly cleaned after that person is discharged, the next person has a very high chance of contracting that disease.
This is Chris Ungerman, CEO of Sanisil International. According to the CDC, 75,000 people die each year from not what they went into the hospital for, but from what they picked up once they got there. The big players here are pathogens like C. diff, MRSA, and pneumonia, all of which can ravage a patient's often already weak immune system. Chris Ungerman thinks he's found a fix. Located deep in an office park in Newcastle, Delaware, he shows off Sanisil's Halo disinfection system. It uses a hydrogen peroxide-based liquid that gets poured into what looks like a slimmed-down airport check-in machine. Tighten the cap, flip it on. It transforms the liquid disinfectant into a fog. That fog disperses throughout the sealed-off room, getting into every corner and crevice, killing all the microorganisms it touches.
It's 99.9999% effective.
The usual way a hospital gets cleaned, chlorine bleach in a spray bottle or wipe, is also effective at taking out pathogens, but bleach only kills what it comes into direct contact with. John Stern says it's pretty easy to miss a spot in a machine-filled space. He's chief of infectious diseases at Pennsylvania Hospital.
The more technology you have in a room, the more surface area you have in a room. The more surface area you have, the more difficult it is to have a human actually clean it. We all know what it's like to try to dust at home. Like myself, I don't even bother.
In 2011, an outbreak of C. diff was moving through the hospital. Stern and his team brought in five foggers to disinfect rooms and found that it cut the transmission rate by more than half. But because of its 90-minute drying time, there is something of a learning curve.
The major problem with it is that it is a little bit challenging to operationalize, meaning that you've got to identify a contaminated room. Housekeeping has to zip in there. They've got to fog the room, which takes several hours, and then clear the room for the next patient. In a very busy hospital like ours, a two-hour delay in moving a new patient in can be a bit challenging, but not insurmountable.
Another challenge right now for hospitals is, of course, the threat of Ebola. But Sanisil and other companies that produce foggers say their tools can be more effective than traditional methods in slowing the spread of the virus. But the CDC's Matt Arduino says it isn't clear yet if they would, in fact, work better in the field.
Well, what we don't have is actual data with the virus itself.
The CDC does list Sanisil's Halo system as an approved disinfectant against Ebola, but it also lists nearly 200 others and doesn't give any one method priority over another. And the truth is, bringing a 50-pound fogger into the outbreak zone with its power cord and $7,000 price tag, it's a heavy lift. Chris Ungerman says aid groups just aren't able to give his machine a shot right now.
A lot of agencies were really not available to look at new technology. They were overwhelmed. They were understaffed, and they defaulted back to chlorine bleach.
Cenacil has delivered a handful of units to Nigeria, but the company also faces bureaucratic headaches and cultural differences. The barriers, he admits, are pretty frustrating.
It has been. There's no doubt that the reaction could have been quicker, and I'm convinced that lives could have been saved by deploying our technology more rapidly.
His team is continuing to work on logistics, but in the meantime, Cenacil also has other targets for its machines. Think nursing homes, hotels, airplanes, and cruise ships. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. On to some curious scientific questions now. For example, what's the relationship between pain and itch? And what about sex equality in scientific studies? Joining us now is regular Pulse contributor, Cy Curious, Bethany Brookshire. She's a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. Hi, Bethany.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Let's start with itch, pain, and then there is kind of serotonin in the middle. There's some new research on that, and that's of personal interest to you, right?
Yes, yes, it is. I suffer from a condition called atopic dermatitis. It's sometimes called eczema, and this means that I itch all the time. So what I found particularly interesting about this is that, you know, many of us have had an itch before, like say we have a mosquito bite. And you have this horrible itch, so you go to scratch it, and you feel so much better, right?
Right.
But then all of a sudden, it itches again.
And worse.
You know how the itch comes back, right? It comes back, and it's worse. So basically, what happens is when you scratch an itch, you actually create pain. And itch and pain share similar nerve pathways in the spinal cord. They actually come down the same way and ascend the same way. And so when you scratch your itch, you produce pain. To kill the pain, your body produces serotonin. But the serotonin comes out near the pain neurons and hits also the itch neurons. And when it hits the itch neurons, it activates them to itch more. So the serotonin kills the pain, but it increases the itch.
So now what? What do we do with this knowledge?
It could help us actually find ways to combat chronic itch. So there's a specific receptor that receives serotonin on the itch neurons. It's called the serotonin 1A receptor. And if we could target that receptor with, say, drugs that specifically target it, we could actually help people who suffer from chronic itch.
And has it changed how you itch and scratch, or just is it just good to know that there's a reason why the itch comes back?
You know, I really wish that it had changed my behavior.
Let's move on to sex equality in scientific studies. The NIH has announced a new policy that will promote sex parity in research. What is this all about?
The National Institutes of Health, or NIH, funds over 300,000 researchers in this country and in other countries to produce, you know, scientific research to help human health. And much of that research until recently has actually been done primarily on one sex or the other. But this means when things translate up to clinical trials for a new drug, for example, we don't necessarily always know how it's going to affect both sexes because it's only been investigated in males or only in females.
So what could the changes look like?
Well, it's tough to say so far. Right now, the first goal is to actually get all scientists to declare in their published papers what sex of animal they used. But there are some thoughts that eventually the NIH will require all experiments to be conducted in both males and females.
But do I have, as a woman, more in common with a female mouse than I do with a male mouse? Is the difference really that big?
It can be, yeah. Certainly, hormones can strongly affect many things in the body. And, you know, males also have hormonal cycling. It just is on a very different schedule compared to females. It tends to be more daily or hourly as opposed to, you know, monthly. Or in the case of, you know, mice and rats, it's every few days.
And what are you hearing from your scientist friends? Is there a bit of grumbling about this, or do people see it as a necessary step?
Opinions appear to be divided. A lot of people welcome it as a very necessary step. Of course, we should be looking at both sexes. I mean, that seems really obvious. But there are some concerns, because if you're going to look in both sexes to make the statistics work out, you really need to double the number of animals. You need to have twice the number of animals that you have, you know, 10 males and 10 females per experiment. And a lot of people are wondering, who's going to pay for that? You know, these animals aren't cheap. They're expensive. They require a lot of care. So how are grants going to be funded to actually pay for those experiments?
So it sounds like a rather complicated process ahead of us. And Bethany, finally this week, I wanted to ask you about some new research on white nose syndrome with bats.
Yeah, there's a new paper just come out this week in Proceedings of the Royal Society B, looking at the seasonality of white nose syndrome and how bats vary in the amount of bats that carry white nose syndrome and are suffering from the disease throughout the year. And it's because bats have a very distinct yearly timeline. And the animals get reinfected in the winter when they're hibernating. And when they hibernate, bats actually have a lower body temperature than they do when they're active. The lower body temperature is really nice and comfortable for the fungus. And so the fungus has a chance to spread and kill more bats during the winter when the animals are hibernating.
And will that knowledge potentially help scientists cure this syndrome?
The authors certainly hope it will help treatments, because now they know when they need to target the treatment. So if you have a new treatment that you think might help combat white nose, you don't want to necessarily give it in the spring, you know, when the animals are becoming active again. You want to actually give it during the winter when they're most likely to be infected. So it might actually help people time their treatments and help prevent the spread.
Bethany Brookshire, also known as SciCurious, writes for Science News and also for the educational blog Eureka Lab. Bethany, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. Imagine you're lying in bed trying to fall asleep while hearing this. This is an example of what it's like to hear voices in your head that other people don't hear. The audio was posted by a woman from the UK named Katie Gray. She has a blog about life with schizophrenia. Hearing voices has long been associated with serious mental illness, and it's been treated as a dangerous symptom. But now, voice hearers, as members of a new movement call themselves, are taking a new approach to living with these voices. Laura Benchoff has this story.
Whispering, yelling, cackling, or buzzing, these are all things people who hear voices might hear. It's like a soundtrack to your life, except you can't turn down the volume.
Filthy-minded. Looking?
Britta Britz is a certified peer specialist and voice hearer in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania. These aren't the voices she hears. She doesn't want to recreate those. But she did say that hers are not very nice.
One of the most common things that they say is, "You belong in flames. Stab the eyes and slash the arms. Crash the car. All that you touch is tainted."
Britz hid her voices for a long time, spending years in and out of hospitals trying to cope. According to Mark Salzer, a psychologist at Temple University, people who tell their doctors that they hear voices might be told to ignore them or have their medications upped or even be told to wear headphones to drown the voices out.
Usually people aren't encouraged to participate in the community, to go to work or go to school or do anything until these symptoms are under control. From a medical model perspective, there's no way you could possibly do anything in your life while you're still hearing voices, so we need to you know, medicate, medicate, medicate.
So the World Hearing Voices movement, which reframes how people think about their voices, has been life-changing for people like Brits.
They teach that it's important to accept your voices as your own, take responsibility for them, and then make sense of them. And it's the making sense of them that's really the most liberating, so that I can really feel that I'm in charge of my own life.
Brits and others in the movement challenge the prevailing medical wisdom that what the voices say isn't important, or worse, that it's dangerous to talk about them.
One of the things I was taught when I was a mental health nurse was that I wasn't to talk to people about their voices, that somehow it would be bad, horrible things would happen to the person, and that the best thing I should do was distract the person.
That's Karen Taylor, a mental health nurse from the UK. She and her husband, Ron Coleman, run Working to Recovery, which works on the same principles as the World Hearing Voices movement. They use something called a voices profile to get people to open up and describe their voices. Through this process, they often find that the voices aren't random. They can be a link to past trauma. Coleman traces some of his own voices to phrases uttered by an abuser from his past, a Catholic priest.
For people like me who are survivors of sexual abuse, I've never had a pill that took that away.
Not everyone who hears voices can connect them to some experience from their life. But Taylor and Coleman believe about 70% can. For those people, talking about the voices helps deal with the root cause instead of medicating it or sweeping it under the rug. And that awareness of trauma is an important shift, says psychologist Mark Salzer.
When we think of violence and mental illness, we think about people with serious mental illness as being perpetrators of violence, when in fact it's entirely the opposite, that individuals with serious mental illnesses are something like 7 to 10 times more likely to be victims of abuse.
Salzer says that this movement gets away from thinking about voices as a problem and helps people focus on quality of life, which might mean living with your voices, like Berta Britz does with hers.
I tell them that I really want to listen to them for 20 or 30 minutes at night, and to please let me focus and be present with people during the day.
Since she joined the World Hearing Voices movement 7 years ago, she's trained her voices to talk differently to her.
So now I have one who will sometimes tell a joke, sometimes give me support.
There are now Hearing Voices movements in 20 countries across the world. For The Pulse, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Coming up on The Pulse, a debate over nasal hygiene.
That's the whole purpose of it. If there's something there to come out, you want it to come out.
Still to come out right here on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to meet your needs. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. It's a personal care habit a lot of people believe in, but there isn't a whole lot of science to back it up. The neti pot. It's this weird plastic kettle you can buy at a drugstore. You fill it with salty water, and then you pour that mixture right into your nostril while kind of tilting your head sideways. For some, it's reminiscent of torture, perhaps waterboarding. Others say it's non-scientific nonsense, but some say it's an essential part of wintertime nose health. We asked Tanya English to investigate the use of the neti pot, but full disclosure, she has a dog in this fight.
I use my neti pot almost every morning, especially in the winter. Slosh some salty water in your nose, and it's like a good kick in the sinuses. I'm hooked. An ear, nose, and throat specialist, Karen Rizzo, says, it's fine.
If you wash your car every day, it stays clean. If it's in the fall when there's ragweed and lots of pollen deposit on it, you wash it away and it looks nice and clean. The same concept with the lining of the nose.
Ultimately, it's your immune system and probably the flu shot that keep you from getting sick. But Rizzo says the nose is part of that system. mucus production kicks into overdrive to fight infection and all the other things that pass through your nose.
Viruses can do that. Bacteria can do that. Allergies can do that. So if you can wash away that agent before it multiplies and spreads, it's a good thing.
Here's the big warning. Rizzo says start with clean water. Wash your hands and sanitize the neti pot every single time. I asked her to watch my technique just to make sure I'm doing it right.
I usually do a couple scoops of salt in there.
Distilled water.
I just pour that in.
Mix it up.
Now the next part is nasty, but Rizzo isn't squeamish.
I always have tissues at the ready. You're not going to be grossed out. You've seen all this stuff before, right?
Absolutely. That's the whole purpose of it. If there's something there to come out, you want it to come out.
Then repeat on the other side.
And a little dribbled out, right?
Yep, very good. That was a nice pace of the pour. The volume was good, and it wasn't uncomfortable, was it?
Not at all.
Yeah. Good.
So otolaryngologist Karen Rizzo recommends regular nasal irrigation. Allergist Talal Unsuli does not.
Now let me clarify it and to avoid having a riot. Here we go. Oh, a lot of people are in love with the nasal saline irrigation. They love their saline water that they use. If they use it short term for 3 days, 1 week, 10 days, that's totally fine.
The right amount of gunk in the lining of your nose is like an immune blanket. And Sully says rinsing it away every day, that's the problem.
Because we are washing the bad mucus that someone can have, yellow-green mucus, but you are washing in the same time the good mucus. And this good mucus contains these immune elements.
And Sully also worries about damage to microscopic hair-like structures called cilia, which wave and beat to sweep mucus from the nose.
And they move like an escalator. Now, studies show that when we use a saline solution, it inhibits, it paralyzes these cilia from moving.
To be specific, it's super salty water that cripples the cilia. And Insuli says lots of do-it-yourself neti potters, like me, do it wrong.
You see atrocities. People, they mix whatever they want. They take 1 teaspoon, 2 teaspoons, 1/2 teaspoon of the salt. They boil their own water. They mix it together. They are not pharmacists to begin with.
He sees patients in his clinic all the time who are trying to treat a serious underlying medical problem with a home remedy. So he did a small study. For a year, Insuli tracked his patients. Everyone got his usual prescriptions and regular medical treatment. But he asked a subset of patients to stop using saline washes completely.
And guess what?
The people who stopped using their neti pots did much better. They had 62% fewer sinus infections.
Exactly.
And Sully says nasal irrigation is a temporary fix.
People think that they're getting better. They might improve probably for 1 or 2 days, and then they start to get worse.
Looking for a final word on the neti pot debate, I asked a national doctors group to be the referee. But no luck. The American Academy of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery, hasn't taken an official position. But me, I'll probably keep swilling the salt water, just not every day. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. Facts can be presented in different ways to tell different stories. If you've served on a jury, you know that. Take, for example, a tale involving a chainsaw, a tricky safety switch, and a subsequent injury. It could be spun into a story of corporate greed, where the bottom line ruled, corners were cut, and consumers were put at risk. Or one could emphasize personal responsibility and foolish, irresponsible use of a chainsaw. Presenting a case to a jury in a convincing fashion is obviously a big part of a lawyer's job, and some are enlisting the help of neuroscience to do their work better. Joining us now are Kelly Yankee and Mark Calzaretta of Magna Legal Services. Both use their backgrounds in neuroscience and psychology to help their clients target specific areas of jurors' brains. Mark and Kelly, thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
Thank you for having us.
Mark, if I'm an attorney in a courtroom, I perhaps am presenting facts, right? Things that I've collected, evidence to a group of people. But you think of it more as a story that's being presented.
I always think of it as a story, and it should be thought of as a story because that's how we communicate every single day with each other. We certainly don't walk up to someone that you're friendly with and start listing out a series of facts. You kind of have a conversation, a comfortable social conversation, and usually it wraps itself around, you know, a story. We react to stories, and they keep our attention. In a courtroom, the most important thing is attention, attention and retention.
And Kelly, how does neuroscience fit into the courtroom and into convincing juries?
Neuroscience from fMRI studies and from a variety of other studies have told us that the brain actually prefers stories. It's more active when we're listening to stories versus listening to just a series of chronological events. One key component here is that when we hear stories about someone else or, you know, about something compelling, this phenomenon called theory of mind takes place, where these older brain structures like the limbic system are actually activated as we're listening to a story that allow us to mentalize or essentially infer the motivations, beliefs, states of others and how that might predict behavior. And we know that this theory of mind exists when we look at fMRI or imaging studies of the brain compared to when they don't hear information in story format. So we know that it actually has a real impact on the brain and the way that we receive the information.
But how do we know which story might appeal to which person? So I'm a mom. If I hear a story about a child or about another mom, I'll relate on that level. If somebody else hears that story, they might relate to another character in that story or to another part.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that as an attorney, when you're going into a venue, you've got 8 or 10, 12 people sitting in front of you. You need to know who those people are, what kinds of themes are really going to resonate with those people based on the experiences they've had in life. You know, and more importantly, from a neuroscience perspective, if you can tie that story or wrap that story around the experiences that they had, they already have a neural network or a neural pathway associated with those experiences that they can tap into. They can actually get into the shoes of the characters and know what that experience is like.
That's when we conduct jury research in any given case, that's what our research, the goals, one of the main goals of the research is to figure out what those predispositions, what those biases are. So what does the mother, in a case that involves a child, bring to the table that another woman of the same age with the same socioeconomic background, the same sort of makeup, but the major difference is she doesn't have any children. How does this affect all different people, and how can we tell a story that sells to everybody, that impacts everybody, so we can give each person the piece that they need in order to have some common ground?
So how do you create that kind of story? You're presenting facts still, you're presenting evidence, but how do you craft that narrative around it that will appeal to a broad audience?
We know that there are certain triggers. We track biases. We track things that are occurring in different venues and different jury pools. So we know that certain things are going to be important. That's just the nature of what we do just from all the research that we've done. So, for example, to use what you were talking about earlier, so you have a case that involves a child, maybe the death of a child, and you have a mother. We know that the role of the mother, the parental role, who was responsible for that child at the time when this event took place, that women who have children are going to be laser focused on that mother's conduct. So that story around her being a good mother and her role there that day, we know is going to be at the forefront of that particular story so that we can set them at ease that, okay, the mother didn't do anything wrong here. Or if you're on the other side, you're defending it, here's what the mother did that you wouldn't do, Miss Juror. You would never care for your child like that, would you?
What kind of information do you have when it comes to the jury selection process?
Well, it depends upon what you have going into, you know, the selection itself. Because with the advent of social media and all these, the internet, and there's just so much information out there and people readily put themselves out there that now you can get all of this kind of information, and we'll have teams of people back at our offices that are combing the web and social media for information on jurors.
Oh.
Even if you have a really funky alias like Kitty999 or something like that, and you have to find that person and match it up, but it's out there.
Where is justice in all of this, and do you think about that? You know, sometimes we look at our legal system and it feels like it's about who did what better in the courtroom, but it's not really about, is this fair? Was it just? So how do you grapple with that as you refine the process to persuade a jury?
It's always an issue, right? And you want to walk out with any profession, you want to walk out at the end of the day and feel good about what you did and feel that what you did was right. And that's the same with juries. And so that dovetails nicely right into jurors want to do the people want to do the right thing overwhelmingly. So, you know, the other thing, 99.9% of every case, civil case at least, does not try. They settle. So there's a big process out there of back and forth of resolving these long before they ever hit the courtroom. And we're part of that process in that resolution process also. When you're in trial, though, it's a battle. Certainly the people with the deep pockets have the ability to work and to really figure out and craft that story. That's the tough part about it. But I feel that it balances on the margin. It balances itself out because there's plenty of those cases where they go in and they think that they're going to do well and the plaintiff really knocks their doors off. So I feel that the jurors on balance, they get it right. I do.
Well, Kelly and Mark, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kelly Yankee and Mark Calzaretta are jury consultants at Magna Legal Services. It's time now for our regular segment, So What Do You Do?, where laypeople sit down with scientists for down-to-earth conversations about their work. This week, Josie Diller, a junior at Norristown Area High School, asked ecologist Danielle Krieger, science director for the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary.
So what do you do?
I'm an environmental scientist, an ecologist, shellfish ecologist, wetland ecologist. My team, they're always saying we need to get the TV program to come out and do world's dirtiest jobs. We can be hip deep in mud, stuck. We could be diving in the Delaware River right here in Philadelphia. We could be releasing electronic tag mussels, which we were doing last week. We think about the big picture needs for the Delaware River and Delaware Bay. For instance, do we need to have more research done to study contaminants in fishes? Do we need to know more about climate change? The ultimate goal is to protect and restore the environment in the Delaware River Basin.
Why do you consider wetlands an important thing? Why are they important not just for the shellfish and not just for the other inhabitants, but how for us are wetlands important?
Wetlands as a habitat type are the most productive ecosystems in our whole areas. So they fix a lot of carbon and they produce a lot of food for other fish and wildlife. In the Delaware Estuary, which has historically been fringed with wetlands from Philly down to Cape May and Cape Henlopen, they form a contiguous fringe of protective barriers, buffers, if you will, between the land and the sea. So that helps to protect coastal communities from flooding. And if you actually add it up, the water quality benefits, because they're like the kidneys of our system, they filter pollutants. If you added the fish and wildlife production, which leads to shell fisheries and fin fisheries, and then you added up the carbon capture, they are extremely important. And the sad fact is we're losing an acre per day of coastal wetlands in the Delaware systems.
Why do you focus on shellfish ecology?
The main reason I'm interested is water quality. Because each of these animals, whether they're in freshwater or in marine systems, filters 10 to 30 gallons of water per day. And they're like natural Brita filters that live in our waterways. And so if we can restore them to their heyday, big populations living all throughout the system, we can have cleaner water.
In your line of work, do you enjoy having a hands-on approach to things, being able to go out into the field and deal with the shellfish and animals that we're discussing?
Absolutely. I'm not by nature an office person. I need to be in the environment as much as possible. There's a variety of different field experiences, and typically when people want to come out and volunteer or learn more about what we do, we tend to take them to the more pleasant field opportunities, particularly if we want to have students not be turned off.
I would be interested in volunteering as long as it wasn't like the knee deep in mud and the hot and the sticky.
The field work is pretty challenging, but it's also super enriching.
Ecologist Danielle Krieger and Josie Dillard, a student journalist and junior at Norristown Area High School. Jeanette Woods produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Gray Tennis is our intern, and this week is his last week with us, and we want to thank him for all the great work he's done for us. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto is the executive producer. Chris Cetullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. Hey, if you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, do subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes and on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And happy birthday to us. The Pulse turns a year old this week. And thank you all for coming along for the ride so far. And we're looking forward to many more great shows to come. We always love to hear from you. So please do email us with your feedback, your questions, your ideas. It's what makes this show fun. At The Pulse at WHYY.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.